We're looking at this whole debate. To begin with, over the next few weeks, we'll be looking more closely at Genesis, the stories of creation, and what modern science tells us about creation. But today we're starting with the whole idea of faith and science. How do they sit together? How do they work together? Or don't they? Because there are many who would actually argue that they don't. That they're quite separate, they should be kept separate, and there is no way in which you can bring them together. Fantastic. Now, this week and one or two weeks, there will be quite a lot of input, because I have to confess straight away that I'm not a scientific person. I don't think scientifically. I know that some of you do. I've been really worried about this, actually, because you know far more than I do about this. I've done my best to read and look into that kind of issues, but I'm pretty much of a Philistine when it comes to science. In fact, I ought to also confess where I'm coming from. I grew up with a kind of absence of science, really. I did it at school, like you do, but I didn't have very inspirational science teachers, sadly. Maybe life would have been different for me if I had, but I struggled with it. And as far as being a Christian was concerned, I grew up with a background of a lot of creationism, particularly coming from America. I got hold of lots of magazines that proved that science was a generally large conspiracy against what the Bible taught. And for a while, I suppose I would have to say that my views on where the world came from were pretty creationist, because I didn't know any better. I don't want to offend anyone who would still say that their views are creationist. One of the things we may discover over the next few weeks, particularly in house groups, I think, is the diversity of views that we have within the church. And that is a good thing. I'm hopeful that we can be respectful of where one another is at. And if you would describe yourself as a creationist, you may not even know what that means, then please don't feel that I will not speak to you ever again, because I certainly held that view for a long period of time in my life. I no longer hold that view. I don't think that is a credible view for me to hold. But I do believe this. I believe that what the Bible teaches is true. It's just not trying to teach science when it comes to its descriptions of creation. So how can we do this? How can we bring the things together? I was almost going to sort of come down and say, okay, well, anyone brave enough to say where they're at in this? And it could range from, I haven't got a clue what any of this is about, I've never even begun to think about these things before, right through to those people who are very scientifically literate and can explain quite a lot of what science says about the creation of the world in which we live, right through to those of us who still feel that perhaps science attacks our faith at certain points, and we're uncomfortable with that. Because if we start not taking what the Bible says about this to be literally true, where do we stop? Where do we end up? And that can be a frightening thing, and some of us might be a bit frightened about what science might be saying. I'm not going to ask you to say, because that would take a lot of guts with this many people around. But I wonder where you are in the whole thing. I hope this morning we'll begin to allow us to work that out. Okay? And we're going to do it with a little bit of help from a bit of video on the screen there, and also on this screen if it's easier to see where we're doing. So let's start the debate. How are we going to make sense of the world in which we live? And if you've never really thought through these things before, I make no apology that in our house groups, I think this is going to be tough. I think it's going to stretch us. There's so much material out there, we could almost drown in it. If you've been to the website that I mentioned last week, testoffaith.com, then you'll know. And it's almost, which bits do we use? Well, that will depend on where we go in each individual house group. So if we could just sort of say to ourselves, let's be open to what God might be wanting to say, then that's the best place to be. Let's make a start. This is from a documentary called Test of Faith, but we're calling our thing Life, the Universe and Everything. It's much more interesting, much more fun, and I'll come back to that on another occasion. The documentary is in three main parts. We're going to see quite a lot of part one today, just some bits that we will lift out. And then next week, and in your house groups, you'll be actually watching part two over the period of 2 weeks in your house groups. Not this week, but the following two. So it will make sense in the end. But here we go. Let's introduce the subject.
At the deepest level, the debate between science and religion is really a debate about how do I obtain reliable knowledge about the world? How do I know that something is true? How do I know that something is false? How do I know that something is reliable, something is unreliable? And that's a terribly important question.
The world divides into two classes. People who think that why is there something rather than nothing is a very deep question. Those who can't see the point of the question. I think why there's something rather than nothing is an important question. And God provides to me the most satisfying answer.
We all try to make sense of our worlds. But how do we know what we know?
I think a lot of people don't live their lives very thoughtfully at all. And everyone's a philosopher in one way or the other. It means they have their own little philosophy, their own theology of what's important, what's not. But a lot of people, they pick up ideas from school, from their parents, from TV, from what they read in the magazine, and they kind of have this patchwork idea of what's true and what's right, wrong, what's important, what's not important. And they live these kind of unexamined lives. And so what the science religion debate helps people do is think, hey, why do I do what I do? Why do I believe in God? Why do I not believe in God? Is it because I was just brought up that way? Or is it because I've really thought about these issues carefully and objectively?
Behind the science religion debate lie challenging questions. What is the nature of our world? How did life come into being? And, most importantly, is the universe pointless, or is there some purpose to it?
I quite liked the phrase in that, I don't know if you picked it out, an unexamined life. Paul encourages us to, specifically in the context of worship and communion, to examine ourselves. We ought to examine ourselves, says Paul. And I think that's a lovely little phrase. We ought to examine ourselves. Examine why we think the way we think. Why we believe what we believe. And certainly it was true for me, as I've already said, growing up, that really in this whole area of my life, I didn't examine things very, very much. I heard a lot of one side of an argument without really listening to another side. I accepted what people were saying without really reflecting on it. And so this series is going to allow me and you to be able to do that, particularly if you're like me and you struggle with all of this. You've already heard there two different scientists. Ard Louis, who is a theoretical physicist at Oxford University. You've also heard John Polkinghorne, who is now an Anglican priest, or was, he's retired. But before that, he had quite a career in science. We'll be hearing lots more. If you go to your house group this week, there'll be interviews with lots of different scientists, believing scientists, who are able to reconcile the two things. So I've given the end of the game away already, haven't I? It is quite possible to reconcile what we believe from the Bible with what we find out about the world through science. If you went to your house group last week, you may well have looked at how science grew out of the believing community. If it wasn't for Christianity, many of our scientists in history wouldn't have done what they did. They believed their faith gave them license to explore the world. But there are still some big questions that blow up, aren't there? The Big Bang. How do you feel about what we now know about the beginning of our universe? Do you know what science says? Or are you fuzzy about it like me? You hear the words Big Bang and you think, well, what does that mean? And I'm not clever enough to understand what it means, because when people start to speak about it, it gets very confusing. Let's be honest about this, if that's where we're at. And that's what our house groups will be doing, I hope, from this week. You may also be worried because there are a lot of scientists who aren't Christian believers. Can you name any? I'm making you work now, aren't I? But I won't do this very much. Can anybody name a scientist who is not a Christian believer? I just did that deliberately because I thought there would be a chorus of Richard Dawkins. He's possibly the best known. There are many, many others. More so, though, this isn't just somebody who is not a Christian. It's someone who is quite militantly atheistic in their thinking. And a scientist who believes that being a scientist means that you couldn't possibly be a Christian. Because if you're a scientist, you're a thinking person, and no thinking person would be a Christian. So we are going to be hearing lots of very, very clever thinking people who are Christians, but we have to identify that there is a movement around, which has been around for quite some time, it has to be said, that argues that faith and science are completely separate. They're different. They cannot come together in any shape or form. And Richard Dawkins is probably the best-known proponent of that whole argument, though he stands in the line of others who have said more or less the same kind of thing. We need to take that seriously. I don't think there's anything to be said about that, but there is an interesting point, which I think, again, is one of those things we will uncover as we go along. If I go back to being a spotty teenager in my creationist phase, in my views, I don't know whether I was a young earth creationist. I'm not sure I even understood the difference. But the idea of a young earth creationist is to say that we don't believe that the world is very old. We're talking thousands of years, and we'll derive our view of how the world has developed from Genesis and what the Bible teaches, even though it's not terribly specific about the time scale. But you can work it out with generations and things like that. So we believe the earth is very young. Now, mainstream science does not believe that. Mainstream science believes the world is very old. The earth, the universe, is incredibly old. We're talking a much, much, much greater length of time. So those two things are fairly incompatible. And yet there is great evidence for what science currently believes. The hypothesis which currently works and is attested to with the evidence that there is. So we have to be very careful here, don't we? Because on the one hand, I defined anyone's right to believe what they believe from the Bible. But if we believe things which are completely at odds with the mainstream position of science about our world, we can be made to look incredibly stupid. And in fact, Richard Dawkins and other atheistic scientists agree completely with young earth creationists, because both groups don't think you can have science and faith and bring them together for different reasons. Both groups believe actually you've got to keep them separate because they don't say the same thing at all. They are, in fact, incompatible. And that's one of the main reasons that I would want to say, apart from understanding a bit more about things, that I have moved away from that kind of position. I think to actually believe that what I believe from the Bible is completely at odds with everything any intelligent scientist will tell you makes my faith look ridiculous and therefore doesn't help people come to know the Lord Jesus. And how can God be in that? So we need to reconcile those two things, don't we? Are you with me on this so far? Are you getting this? Are you with it? You're not offended yet, are you? It's very hard to do this without offending somebody somewhere along the line. Let's just look at this idea of the way in which perhaps some people have driven a wedge between science and faith in the past. Some of you will know there was an historic occasion in 1860. A historic occasion when Samuel Wilberforce, no relation to William Wilberforce, he was a bishop, had a debate in Oxford with the leading, we might actually call him an atheist nowadays, but he actually coined the word agnostic for what he thought and believed. But he was known as Darwin's bulldog. He defended evolution for Darwin. His name was Thomas Huxley. And this is a famous debate where apparently, and we're never really entirely sure exactly how it happened and what happened, but people kept referring to apes and grandparents being descended from various monkeys and so on, and we are to understand that the whole thing ended in insulting one another. I'm not sure whether that's true or not. Both sides claimed victory, but the debate was simply about could we believe what the Bible says with emerging scientific theory. Let's hear a little bit more about that and this man, Thomas Huxley. We're going to hear from Professor Peter Harrison and how he believes science and faith have kind of driven apart. And we've kind of inherited that, and that's why many people, many Christians, are a bit uncomfortable with the whole debate at the moment. Here's Peter Harrison.
Today, science is often used to bolster atheism. But modern science actually emerged out of Christian Europe. So what brought us to where we are today? Peter Harrison claims a British biologist has been instrumental in driving a wedge between science and religion.
What Thomas Huxley saw in Darwinism was the potential to make biology scientific and to give it a significant public profile and to make science something that was important in society in a way in which it wasn't. And part of that meant, in a sense, prizing science from the hands of the clergy, who, for various reasons, had tended to dominate scientific positions and the scientific establishment for quite a long time. The strategy he used, you might call it a kind of wedge strategy, was to say, actually, science and religion are different activities, they're in conflict, the clergy hands off the sciences, leave it to the true professional.
Sir John Polkinghorne has refused to be hands-off with science. Formerly a top particle physicist at Cambridge University, he left his academic post in mid-career to be ordained in the Anglican Church. Today, he's regarded as a world authority on both religion and science. He maintains they share a common goal.
They're both concerned with the search for truth, obviously for different aspects of truth, but those aspects have to fit together in some sort of way. We're very familiar with that sort of fact. The kettle's boiling because burning gas heats the water. Kettle's boiling because I want to make a cup of tea. Would you like to have one? We don't have to choose between those two. In fact, if we're to understand the mysterious event of the boiling kettle, we need both those forms of explanation. Similarly, I think science tells us how the world works, but religion tells us there is a meaning and purpose, something being fulfilled in the unfolding of the history of the world. So I need both those perspectives if I'm truly to understand the really rich and remarkable world in which we live.
So you'll probably be familiar with that way of bringing together both science and our belief. The fact that what we're doing here is answering different kinds of questions. We're not getting on to Genesis this week. We're coming to that. That's the kind of big whole area in which there is this perceived difference. But we're talking about different kinds of questions, as Sir John said there, about the kettle. Science can tell us lots about the world in which we live and describe it and define it and say what will happen and what should happen and then predict what might happen based on what we know. It can look back and tell us with quite a lot of clarity what must have happened in the creation of our universe, but it can never answer the questions as to why these things happened or what is behind it. They are different kinds of questions. And the argument would be that Genesis and the Bible is not teaching the science of how things happened. How could it possibly? So much of what we know scientifically has happened in the last, 200 or 300 years. Obviously some great scientific discoveries before that, but so much, and even the last century, an explosion of what we know. It's changing all the time as scientists push on, as researchers push the frontiers of our understanding and knowledge. How could the Bible be competing with that? It's not what it's trying to do. But what we might expect is that anything that we discover about the world through science will be completely compatible with what God has revealed to us in the Bible. After all, if we believe he is the creator and he is behind it all and it's his universe, it would be very odd if it was not compatible. And so when we're looking into the accounts in Genesis, as we shall be doing, and other parts of the Bible as well, what we're looking at there is what God is telling us, not about how it all came into being, but why. And that he's a God who loves people, and that this is part of his great plan and purpose. That we don't live in a random, pointless world, but one which is rich with possibility and ripe for exploring and using the intelligence that God has given us. Ard Louis, we saw him at the beginning. I'm getting to like Ard Louis. You'll see little clips of him throughout this series. Theoretical physicist at Oxford University. I understand absolutely nothing of what he says as a scientist. But he gets very excited when he's speaking about one of the discoveries that was made about 75, 80 years ago now, back in 1928. He talks about Paul Dirac, who predicted in a paper the possibility of antimatter. Don't worry about the the rest of this, all right? Everything around us is matter, but no one had really thought much about antimatter. There are one or two things, if you go back in history, that sort of mention it, but they hadn't been taken seriously. But this guy, Dirac, was a mathematician, and he put together the theory about very small things that he was working on, together with Einstein's theory about speed. And as he did that, it created this idea that there had to be some kind of anti-electron. Don't ask me how or why or whatever. But no one had discovered this. No one knew anything about it. But that's the logical inference of what he was doing. Now, Ard Louis gets very excited about this. He writes all the maths up on the board and the equations and everything else. He's excited because 4 years later, someone actually discovered it. They found what had been predicted. Paul Dirac had not called it antimatter at that stage, but it's logical progression from that find 4 years after he'd written about his anti-electrons. And Ard Louis sees that we live in a world which is full of purpose, which is full of the way things work together according to the laws of physics that we are discovering more and more about. And that for him speaks, because he's a Christian, of a God who loves and cares and has set up a universe that can be explored and makes sense. And he gets excited when that happens. A way of bringing these things firmly together. We're going to look a little bit more at that in the next clip. And I've just begun to get my head round this. So let's look at that.
Is there any scientific basis for thinking our universe may have been created with purpose? John Polkinghorne worked alongside an astronomer who made a critical discovery that shook his beliefs.
One of the great triumphs of astrophysics in the second half of the 20th century was to figure out how the elements are made. Because the very early universe is very simple, it only makes very simple elements, in fact, hydrogen and helium. The two simplest elements, and you can't really do very much with them. They have very boring chemistry. You need much more elements if you're going to have something as interesting as life, and in particular you need carbon. The chemistry of life is the chemistry of carbon. So where does carbon come from? There's only one place in the whole universe where carbon is made. It's made in the interior nuclear furnaces of the stars. Every atom of carbon in our bodies was once inside a star. We're people of stardust. Now, how that happened was figured out in Cambridge. Fred Hoyle, a senior colleague of mine, was one of the leading figures in this. And they were trying to figure out how carbon was made. They had helium, and if they could make three heliums stick together, that would make carbon. But they couldn't figure out how to do that. To get three small things like that stick together at once, you can't do it. Okay, say, let's do it bit by bit, make two stick together, that makes beryllium, stays around a bit, another one comes along, makes carbon. But it doesn't work, because beryllium is very, very unstable. It just disappears like that. So they were stuck. And then Fred had a good idea, and he said, it'll just go if there is something called a resonance, a very enhanced effect, which is just at the right energy in carbon to make that extra one stick on much, much more quickly than you would have thought. So he was very pleased with himself. We went off the nuclear data tables just to check that this resonance, this effect, was there, and it wasn't. And so he was... Fred was a very stubborn and persistent friend. He rang up some friends in the States and said, look, you've missed something in carbon. There's a resonance there that you haven't spotted, and I know exactly where it is, so you had to have this energy. And they were probably a bit reluctant to look, but in the end they went and looked, and they found it. That's a wonderful scientific story. But also it stuck Fred. It is more than a scientific story, because of course if the laws of nuclear physics had been a tiny bit different, either there would be no resonance at all, or it would be some other energy which would be no good. And Fred, who had a lifelong commitment to atheism, is reported to have said, in the Yorkshire accent, beyond my powers to imitate, the universe is a put-up job. In other words, this can't be just a happy accident. This is too significant for that. There must be something behind all this. Because Fred didn't like the word God, he says some capital I intelligence has monkeyed with the laws of the universe.
Observing the universe, then, can spring riddles for atheism, too. Hoyle's groundbreaking discovery led to what subsequently became known as the anthropic principle.
I'm sorry if you're listening sort of near the front. He gabbles, that chap, doesn't he, Sir John? I hope you can get just enough of what he's saying. This great discovery that Fred Hoyle made. Fred Hoyle, an atheist, couldn't quite get his head around the fact that if something had been just ever so slightly different, then it wouldn't be possible for any of us to be alive, because it wouldn't be possible for those building blocks of life to work. And as you heard at the end there, this anthropic principle that our world is so finely tuned, and all the way along has had to be for us to develop in the way that we have developed, according to what we know about evolutionary theory and so forth, in order that we're here. Now, if you struggle with all of this, and you're struggling with me even now, some of you may have read Bill Bryson, A Short History of Nearly Everything. I do recommend it. It's still quite hard going for some of us, but it's not as bad because it's not written by a scientist, but it covers what we know about the world in which we live. It's a few years old now, so already it's beginning to get out of date. But this book I have found incredibly useful. There will be a copy in the library when I put this one back. I do recommend that to try and get your head round. But the anthropic principle simply says that the world is so finely tuned to produce you and me. And we couldn't be here today talking about this and thinking about this and engaging with this if even a very slight variation in things, gravity for instance, we're still wanting to try and find if there is intelligent life anywhere else in the universe. As far as we know, nowhere else in the universe has produced the conditions possible for our kind of life. And that begins to make us go back to that question which was formed by Leibniz in the 18th century. Why is there something rather than nothing? Why do we exist as we exist? Surely it cannot just be chance. Surely there has got to be some meaning, some purpose. Now, of course, others will not believe that. But so many people, whether we're Christians or not, whether we're scientists or not, cannot believe that this world in which we live could have happened and could have evolved simply without any kind of purpose. Science tells us so much about how that has happened. But when on Wednesday, I was in the middle of this great wind. We've had a lot of wind this week, haven't we? It blew up the leaves all around me. I was kind of lost in this haze of leaves blowing around me, and I felt a great exhilaration. And science can tell me so much, and I'm learning about it, about air pressure and molecules and why it was all around me and what was happening with the leaves and so on, but it cannot say very much about the exhilaration I felt in the middle of all of that, can it? I mean, it can talk about brain chemistry and so on, but we don't get very far with that. And likewise, driving, as I said, driving through those great arches of trees with their leaves and the colours. It was beautiful. It was thrilling. It did something to my insides or my soul or whatever you want to call it that I cannot describe particularly scientifically. Even if I can talk about the life cycle of trees, I can talk about, even through simple observation, that every year at about this time, lots of the leaves fall off. I mean, I can keep it very simple scientifically. We can do things scientifically, but we cannot get to the bottom. Reading this book, it puts things in a very simple way. There's sort of a 20-kilometer kind of height and depth. We've just had this story, haven't we, about the miners underground, and obviously they survived, and we're really great about that. If you go underground a little way, you'll be able to survive. Go too far, and you won't. Go that way a little bit on an aeroplane and you'll survive. You can even survive if you take an artificial atmosphere with you going to the moon. We know that, it's happened. But if you don't take that artificial atmosphere and everything else with you, you can't go too far up that way and you won't survive. The conditions for life, it's about 20 kilometres, I understand, from down there to up there in a ring around this planet. And this planet is a tiny speck in the universe. And some people believe there are more universes out there. Why? The anthropic principle that everything is finely tuned for life here, surely, surely, how can you understand that unless you have a belief in a divine intelligence behind it? Even Fred Hoyle, the atheist, thought the universe was a put-up job. There's some kind of intelligence behind it, even though he didn't want to admit to it. So where are we going to go with all of this? Let me read, because we've got to conclude today, but it kind of rolls on. This is our reading, and as you have heard, this isn't a typical sermon. I apologise, I didn't know any other way of starting this off, but this is Colossians chapter 1 from verse 15, talking about Jesus. Jesus, this passage says, Jesus is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. For by him all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible. The vast majority of what's around us is pretty invisible. I don't know about atoms. Sorry, I sound really, really kind of enthusiastic, don't I? No, I don't. But I just found some of this stuff out for the first time in my life. Atoms. Atoms are made up of pretty much nothing, aren't they? You know, the electron, or the nucleus, where the electron and the rest of it is, someone described it somewhere as being like a penny in a huge cathedral, and the rest of it's empty, so I understand. Although we're now wondering whether that's true. But that's the nature of science, you see. You begin to sort of question all of this. But you see, Jesus is the image of God. He's the firstborn over all creation, of all that is visible and invisible. It all belongs to him. It all makes sense in him. It doesn't make sense without him. We don't need to be frightened of science. So Jesus, through all things, were created through him, whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities, all things created by him and for him. He's before all things, and in him all things hold together. He's the head of the body, the church. He's the beginning, the firstborn from among the dead, so that everything, in everything, he might have the supremacy. For God was pleased to have all his fullness dwell in him, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, not just all people, but all things, everything, in the known and unknown universe. Jesus is central. Jesus is supreme. Everything finds its meaning and purpose in him, because it came from him. That's me saying that. I'm back to the Bible now. Jesus does this by making peace through his blood shed on the cross. It's not just about my sin. It's about this universe coming back to what God intended for it. That's what the cross of Jesus Christ does. Once, says Paul in this letter, once you were alienated from God, you were enemies in your minds because of your evil behavior. But now he has reconciled you by Christ's physical body through death to present you holy in his sight, without blemish and free from accusation, if you continue in your faith, established and firm, not moved from the hope held out in the gospel. This is the gospel that you have heard and has been proclaimed to every creature under heaven, and of which I, Paul, have become a servant. I want to tell you that I am committed more than ever in my life to the authenticity of the Bible as God's revealed word. What it says is true in all that it affirms and all that it is saying. And as I learn more and more about science and gain more and more respect for those believing scientists who are so much cleverer than I recognize that in them too, they believe this. This is not an add-on to their scientific understanding. This is the heart of it, because God has created a world in which you and I can exist. And science tells us some of how that has come to be. And he's given us minds that inquire into it, that can understand it and make sense of it. And he wants us to enjoy that exploration and to learn from it. At the same time, to be humble and recognize that however much we understand, there are so many more things that we don't understand. And quite possibly never will understand, however much we push back those frontiers of science. That's why scientists have no trouble reconciling the work that they do and the faith that they have, because they believe in a God who through Jesus is reconciling everything together in himself. Here's our last clip. We're nearly there.
The 18th century philosopher Leibniz asked, why is there something rather than nothing? Science has described how our universe began with stunning success. But three centuries later, science is still unable to answer Leibniz's question.
The scientific understanding of the Big Bang tells us a lot. It tells us about the dynamics and the contents and the evolution of the universe as it was at early times and as it's evolving into now. But science and our detailed scientific understanding of the Big Bang doesn't actually address the question of meaning. That's not science. Doesn't mean it's untrue, but it is different from science. And that's where bringing in other truths about the reality of human existence comes in. You know, we can describe the age of the universe, we can describe how stars and galaxies have evolved over time, we can describe all these things, but we can't answer why is there a universe at all, and why is there a universe that would evolve toward the point of having human beings that are having the kinds of conversation we're having right now. Why are there concepts of hatred and love, and why do people do things to each other that don't promulgate natural selection or survival of species, that make no sense? You know, why a lot of things just aren't answered through science, and I think most people, both Christian and non-Christian, are grateful for that, because there's a lot of interesting things about life that don't have to do with measuring physical forces of nature.
These scientist believers, then, say science must acknowledge its limits. But they also say faith must be consistent with what we know through science, rather than being based in what we don't know. For them, a God of the universe could hardly be threatened by any advances in human knowledge.
That's why I think it's exciting as Christians to go exploring, because we're never going to find anything that's outside of God's realm. Everything is part of this majestic creation, and the more you discover, the more amazed you get by thinking about God. And so I think exploration is a divinely Christian activity, and people should be excited about it.
I don't know if you are excited, but I guess you've probably got lots of questions. I hope you have, because I hope that this particular opening has brought to the surface, yeah, but what about? Enjoy your house groups this week. We'll start digging into Genesis a bit more next week, and that will follow through to the house groups as well. If you want to come and chat to me about things, please do, but I am no expert in this, and there are people around us here who are far more scientific than I am and may have better answers to some of your questions. I want to simply finish leaving it open now for us to go and explore some more. We shall pray. And just to say that this afternoon at 3:30, we have a communion service. It's the first Sunday of the month. So if you would like to come, please come at 3:30 to our communion service. Thank you for working hard. I hope it was a bit different, but I hope it was okay this morning. Let's pray together.